Government bracing for another surge. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Times. The lead headline in the Irish Examiner, meanwhile, notes that the 769 COVID cases reported yesterday marked the highest number of new cases in more than 3 weeks. Both papers also report that the mandatory hotel quarantine regime for passengers arriving from high-risk countries is expected to finally open this week, with a booking system due to go live either today or tomorrow. The Examiner details how, as you'll have heard in the bulletin, the TIFCO Hotel Group, which operates 24 hotels around the country, is likely to be awarded the contract. For its lead story, the Irish Independent reports that members of NPHET called for all passengers flying into the country, and not just from the current list of 33 countries, to be quarantined. While the Irish Daily Mirror leads with the line that yesterday's figures mean that Easter celebrations are likely to be off again this year. The investigation into the death of two women and a man in Newton Abbey, County Antrim, on Friday night generates the lead story in both the Irish News and Belfast Telegraph. The Irish Daily Star leads with the three-year prison sentence which 24-year-old Bernard McGovern received last Friday for an attack on businessmen Kevin Lunny and Ara O'Reilly at a service station in Cavan in February 2019. For its lead story, the Irish Sun interviews a software engineer who says that he has removed more than a million online explicit images, many of which are of Irish women, since last November. Elsewhere on the front pages, the Examiner's political correspondent Aoife Moore writes that, according to senior party sources, Fine Gael is in turmoil over the ongoing criminal probe into Taoiseach the Leo Varadkar. Paul Williams reports in The Independent that Gardaí have already seized almost as many drugs in the first 10 weeks of this year as they did in all of 2020. The plan to build a €25 million whitewater rafting attraction in Dublin's Docklands has suffered a setback after the government refused a request to fund it. That's on the front of The Times. In terms of pictures, The Independent runs with the front page image of 6-year-old Emily McCarthy surrounded by golden daffodils at Elmgrove Farm in County Meath, which is helping to raise funds for the Irish Cancer Society's annual daffodil campaign. The picture on the front of The Examiner shows an aerial shot of some beach art drawn in the sand in Ballybunion, County Kerry, which was shared on social media yesterday to celebrate World Down Syndrome Day. And finally, Nick Bradshaw's striking picture on the front of today's Times is of a siskin and a goldfinch in Delgany, County Wicklow, engaged in a beak-to-beak battle at a bird feeder.
Now, the long-awaited mandatory hotel quarantining plan for people arriving from named high-risk countries is expected to be finally up and running later this week. People arriving here from 33 named countries will have to spend 2 weeks in quarantine at their own expense at a hotel, which will have private security. Reports are that the contract is being awarded to the TIFCO Hotel Group. It has 24 hotels across the country, including at Dublin and Cork airports. Joining me now with more details is the Irish Times political correspondent Harry McGee. And Harry, what can you tell us about this system and how it's going to work for the passengers that arrive into Ireland from these named countries from later this week?
Well, it does show you, Mary, how long it takes for a decision to become implemented in the Irish political system. This has been incredibly quick in the context of the Oireachtas. This was first mooted some 6 weeks ago and has now finally become real. The legislation was passed 2 weeks ago and the system looks like it's going to start operating on Thursday. And essentially those arriving from 33 named countries around the world where the variants of coronavirus are high will be asked to quarantine for a period of 2 weeks in a hotel campus at their own cost, as you said, and that's going to cost about €2,000. So when they arrive at the airport, once they come into arrivals and have been identified as incoming passengers who have to quarantine, they will be accompanied to the airport. They will be transported by bus to one of these hotels and will have to remain essentially in the room for a period of 2 weeks with full board. All meals will be provided, and there are certain circumstances outlined in the legislation that will allow them to leave their rooms, but they essentially are only emergency situations. As first reported by your own correspondent Micheál Lehane last night, it looks like TIFCO, the hotel group, has been awarded the contract, Mary. They have 24 properties around the state, including the Crown Plaza, the Holiday Inn Express near Dublin Airport. They have Travelodge Hotels, the Hilton in Kilmainham, and also Clontarf Castle. So at least some of those properties in the vicinity of airports, especially Dublin Airport, will be used over the next 2 weeks. So it's a very punitive system. The legislation is very complicated. Essentially, people are put under house arrest for a period of fortnight until they are given the all clear.
Yeah, and it is anticipated, Harry, that this will be cost neutral to the state. I know further details will come to us as the week goes on, but at this stage, what do we know about the involvement, if any, of An Garda Síochána, the involvement of the Defence Forces, and how the whole policing of this quarantine will be carried out?
Yeah, this is something that's proved to be problematic during the whole drafting process. My own understanding is that no Gardaí will be involved on any of the properties unless there are breaches of the law or breaches of rules that have accompanied the legislation. It will be private security firms who will operate. There will be very strict protocols as to what they can and what they can't do. If it looks like the law or rules are being breached, it's at that stage that Gardaí will be called in. But as you said, more details of the exact nature of what the Gardaí will and won't do will become apparent over the next 2 weeks.
And it extends to 33 named countries at the moment. But Sinn Féin and others, including the Irish Independent reporting this morning, NPHET wanted mandatory hotel quarantining imposed on everyone arriving here. Is it likely we'll see the 33 country list expanded or even extended to everyone arriving into the country, depending on how these COVID numbers go?
I don't think it's going to be extended to every person arriving into the country, but it does look like that list of 33 will be expanded and include more countries where the variant is high. If you were to go to every country, you'd be going to almost to a zero COVID situation. And then there's the difficulty with the border. There are also difficulties in relation to our relationship with the UK on common travel and also with the 27 EU states as well. So from a legal perspective and also from a practical perspective, that would be very, very difficult indeed to do. But it is likely that the number of countries will be increased. But people think that this perhaps will be the panacea to everybody's problems, and it won't. As it showed yesterday, the figures have risen again. Now, it might have been just a once-off blip yesterday with the figures rising to over 700. But the difficulty at the moment has less to do with foreign travel than to do with community transmission here in Ireland. And as we were reporting this morning, there's already some concern that we might be having a mini, or perhaps even more than a mini, fourth wave during the course of Easter, which might chill expectations.
Sorry, Harry, on that, and briefly, the politics of the next couple of weeks ahead of April 5th, when, you know, there is some anticipation of an easing of restrictions. What could happen?
Well, it will depend on the figures. There are two conflicting forces, essentially. You have the numbers, and the numbers have remained stubbornly high. They haven't fallen as they've fallen with past outbreaks. And then there's also the kind of the pent-up feeling, this feeling of cabin fever that people have had because of a long period of lockdown, which has extended really since the new year. There will be relaxing. I think the 5 kilometre limit will go. I think children under the age of 18 will be allowed to do exercise in pods. I think construction will return partially. But I think if people are expecting wider relaxations in April, I don't think they're going to happen because the numbers are still too high.
All right. Harry McGee of the Irish Times, thank you. And it was some members, not all members of NPHET, on that question of extending mandatory hotel quarantining for all.
Well, one thing that is changing today is to do with nursing homes, because from today, people with loved ones there can visit them twice a week
on compassionate grounds. The one-hour time limit for visits has been lifted, and visits can take place from people living more than 5 kilometres away from the nursing home. We're joined this morning by Mairead Blackhall, whose 94-year-old mum, Lorna, is in a nursing home in Kildare, and by Gordon Glynn, who is manager of Kiltomer Nursing Home in Galway. You're both welcome, and good to have you on our programme this morning. Mairead, will you head in to see your mum today?
Hi, morning to you. No, not today. Visits have to be organised, so it's Wednesday before I'll be able to head into mum. But okay. Yes, on Wednesday, I'm absolutely looking forward to getting in to see her in her residence.
And I bet she's looking forward to seeing you.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's been a very, very difficult year. Mum got COVID, survived it, is in a wonderful nursing home, and, you know, it's just been a very, very difficult year. Window visits just, you know, at that age are incredibly difficult.
How do they work, Mairead? What did you and your mum have to do over the last year?
Well, how they work in reality is, you know, you're at a window, I'm on my mobile phone outside the window, ringing her in a number in her particular room that she's brought to. She has to come down from her fabulous room, which is like a little apartment, come down by wheelchair, and, you know, we talk, and she's well able to talk, and we do talk through the window by phone, but you can imagine how difficult that is. There's no, we're a tactile family, there's no touch, and there's no seeing anybody else. Like at a window, it's either one or two of us, and that's it. No grandchildren, no great-grandchildren, you know, the loss of all of that for the last year.
Absolutely. Gordon, I'm going to come to you now in a second. I just want to play a clip of the Executive Director of Sage Advocacy, who represents those living in nursing homes. Sarah Lennon told our reporter Fiacra O'Connor last night that not all nursing homes will comply with the guidelines immediately. These are the new guidelines coming into effect from today, and that families should check with individual nursing homes to be sure what to expect. Let's hear her.
It's very welcome that from today, HSE guidelines do permit facilitation of increased visits to nursing home residents. But it's very fair to say that there's a mixed picture on the ground. We've received some reports that nursing homes have actually begun to implement the visits already ahead of the guidelines. But we've also received calls that some nursing homes are not facilitating indoor visits at all, or others are only allowing one per week instead of the two that the guidelines allow, limiting it to 30 minutes. Instead of the minimum of 60 minutes that the guidelines allow, and some nursing homes have insisted that visitors are being tested for COVID-19, despite the guidelines saying that testing visitors in advance is not required at present.
That's Sarah Lennon there of Sage. Well, Gordon Glynn is manager of Kiltomer Nursing Home in Galway, and he's on the line as well. Gordon, let's just go through some of the nuts and bolts of how this will work as far as you're concerned with your nursing home. First of all, will there be, do you imagine, a liberal definition of compassionate grounds for which these visits can go ahead?
Yeah, of course, we're so excited at the moment that the visiting is returning, and all our residents and all the staff are so excited with all happening. So we're welcoming it because we've gone through probably the toughest year that anyone has ever imagined at the moment, and we're happy to see some light at the end of the tunnel, and anything that will lift the residents' spirits, we'll be happy to go ahead with it.
And two visitors a week, do you know, can they be different visitors? Is it just one visitor at any one time?
Yeah, it can be two different visitors per week at the moment. We're lucky enough that we are a small unit of a nursing home. I know Mairead is saying that she probably can't get in until Wednesday, but the smaller the centre, I suppose, the easier it is to get an appointment to see the residents. And I agree too with Mairead that the window visits were tough. It was tough on us too, it's tough on the residents, but unfortunately that was the guidance we had, and to keep everyone safe, he says that we had to go with them guidelines.
And will the visitors coming to your nursing home, will they have to wear PPE, Gordon?
If it's an outside, we have two outside areas for visiting which does not require PPE, just social distancing, but we have an indoor visiting area alone, and you just have to wear a face mask in there.
Okay, and who will your first visitors be today?
Well, we're delighted. Our first visit is a couple. The resident in the nursing home, he's with us for about 2 years now, and his wife is the first visit. Now we just booked them in. They're in at 10 o'clock this morning. They're over 50 years married, and she's been coming down every week doing the visits, the window visits, and just so heartwarming to see that they're the first ones that are going to get the visit. So we're going to make a big deal about it, maybe have a cup of tea and maybe crack open a bottle of champagne. We obviously won't be drinking champagne that hour in the morning, but we'll celebrate and have a bit of excitement to kick off what hopes to be a good, positive day.
It's going to be an emotional day, isn't it, for you and your staff, as well as the visitors, as well as the families all getting together?
Oh, it's extremely emotional, because especially over the last year, how close we've got to all our residents has been astounding, that we've had to be their visits for the last year when their family couldn't come in. So, and even over the phone, you can hear it in people's voices, how excited that they are. And even my daughter is actually a pen pal with one of the residents in the nursing home, and she wrote her a letter last week to say she was so excited that the visits were starting up again. So it's great to see that as well. So we'll be emotional, let's say, as well as everyone else.
Yeah, exactly. And Mairead, your mother, 94, I think, did you explain the lockdown to her in terms of World War II, because she's Scottish?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, Mum is 94. She will celebrate her 95th birthday, which we hope to be in her fabulous little room with her on the 10th of April. And yes, that's how we got through lockdown. She was evacuated. She's actually Scottish, evacuated during the war, and went away as a 12-year-old and didn't come back to her home in Glasgow until she was 16. So it's, you know, even though she's 95, she's very, very with it, just very fragile. And to us, to get back in to see her in her room is really one of the most important things ever. Because, you know, for her to have those window visits or any visit meant, you know, out of her beautiful armchair in her room, into a wheelchair and down to a designated kind of area for the window visit. So we're looking forward to the end of that. And
she's looking forward to meeting the newest addition to the family.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in this year, there's been another, she has three great-grandchildren, and, you know, you can appreciate at the window, you're not bringing a whole load of family with you. It has just been me or one of my siblings, my sister. So the extended family, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, just not possible, you know. So we're just hoping that we can, obviously we have to move slowly and carefully. People have to be very careful. But her nursing home is, you know, they are all vaccinated, staff and residents. And really, the new guidelines from the Health Protection Surveillance Centre are very clear. That, you know, family have to get in, and we have to get in a meaningful way, and visits have to be meaningful.
Exactly. Well, look, Mairead, enjoy Wednesday. I know it'll mean a lot to you. And thank you very much for talking to us this morning, Mairead Blackhall. And Gordon, enjoy today. And we wish you all the very best. Gordon Glynn, manager of Kiltomer Nursing Home in Galway. And I suppose the advice is, if you have a loved one in a nursing home, just get in touch with the nursing home and see what you have to do in order to make that visit.
Now, worries in Ireland about stalled COVID numbers and fears of a further wave of infections are mirrored across Europe. A sharp rise in infections and the EU's continued struggle to get its vaccination programme up to speed have forced some countries back into lockdown and further restrictions. The weekend also saw thousands of protesters angry at COVID-19 restrictions rallying in cities around Europe. Martin McKee is Professor of European Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning.
Are we on the cusp of, or are we in a new wave of this pandemic?
Well, we're in a new wave, but of course it does vary between countries. So it's quite a variable pattern, quite simply because the restrictions that are put in place are bounded by the national borders. So some countries are beginning to just turn the corner a bit, but some that were actually relatively unaffected at the beginning, like Finland and Estonia, which have done remarkably well, are seeing numbers going up quite rapidly. France, Germany, Hungary, Austria, and others are clearly well into another wave.
And are the characteristics of this wave of the pandemic different to what we saw perhaps at the start back last March?
Essentially, they're the same. Excuse me. They're the same. This is a virus that is transmitted in situations where large numbers of people come together in close proximity, particularly indoors. But the difference is that we're now seeing the impact of the new variants, and in particular the B117 variant, the one that originally came from Kent in England, although there is also a rather worrying level of some of the others from particularly South Africa. And these variants are more transmissible. They seem to leave people infected for a longer period of time. And what we saw, in fact, in the period before Christmas in Great Britain was that the restrictions that were in place that had controlled the initial variants were no longer working. The virus was able to evade them, and so you really needed to have the strictest level of restrictions to control them. And unfortunately, that's the situation elsewhere. We just need to ramp up. It's the same principles that you'd need to minimize the opportunities for the virus to spread, but you just need to do them more intensively, unfortunately.
And I suppose the difficulty is that at a time when you say we need to ramp up, it is a time when people have reached perhaps the limit of their capacity to stick to these restrictions. They're tired and they're exhausted.
Well, they're certainly tired and they're exhausted, but I'm not quite sure what the alternative is. Because the good thing, of course, is that we're coming into summer, so it is much easier for people to meet outdoors. And the reality of it is that this virus is very unlikely to spread if people are maintaining some degree of distance outdoors. It's the indoor settings that are the problem. So with that, we do have the advantage of summer, spring and summer coming along. But as I say, I'm not quite sure what the alternative is, because if you actually just do open up everything, then you get a situation like Brazil, which we can see, where the hospitals are overwhelmed, where they're running out of oxygen, and where people are dying in enormous numbers. And I don't think any society can tolerate that.
Is the alternative and the hope, though, vaccination and having that critical mass of people vaccinated?
Yes, but we're a long way to go for that, because we often talk about the percentage of the adult population that's vaccinated, but if we're good to get population immunity, we need to get the entire population vaccinated, and we're only beginning to do the trials in children, so that will be the next step. So even if we were to vaccinate all of the adult population in most of our countries, we'd get up to about 80%. We need to do more than that to control the transmission. There is good news. The vaccine does seem to be reducing transmission of the virus. But also we need to then look at the people who are likely to be left behind. And that means a really strenuous effort to look at, for example, homeless people, people in minority populations who may have difficulty accessing care or may need to have messages in different languages. So this is actually about solidarity. We're all in it together, and we need to make sure that nobody is left behind, because otherwise this is a problem for everybody.
Professor Martin McKee, thank you very much. 7:31.
The average loss to a small and medium-sized enterprise here arising from fraud stood at just below €4,000 last year. This is according to research carried out by Bank of Ireland, in which it surveyed over 300 SMEs. It found that over a third of SMEs here had been targeted by fraud in the past year, and it's become more of an issue since COVID, with staff working remotely. 400 new jobs are to be created in Dublin by US cloud-based finance and human resources software developer Workday, with recruitment starting immediately. Workday first came to Ireland 13 years ago when it bought Irish technology firm Cape Clear. An advisor to Donald Trump has told Fox News that the former president is to return to social media in the months ahead with his own platform. He was suspended from Twitter and Facebook after January's riots at the US Capitol in Washington. Jason Miller said the platform would be the hottest ticket in social media. On the currency markets, the euro is trading at $1.18.8 and 85.8 pence sterling.
And at 7:37, what a weekend in sport. Here's Darren Frahill. Morning, Darren.
Yes, good morning, Audrey. It was indeed. And usually on a Monday morning, I like to get things off to a nice positive start, but I'm afraid I've got some pretty bad news in relation to the Irish soccer squad this morning, because that injury list, that long injury list, is getting longer by the day. Kevin Long, Caoimhín Kelleher, Conor Hourihan and Callum O'Dowda have all been ruled out of the World Cup qualifier against Serbia on Wednesday. And it's a big blow for the Irish manager, Stephen Kenny, ahead of this particular match. He must be getting used to these blows at this stage, because they've just come like waves almost. Already missing Darren Randolph. So that means we'll be down to our third choice goalkeeper. John Egan is out. James McCarthy. These guys would have been considered frontline players. Adam Ida, Jack Byrne also out. Two other players, Aaron Connolly and James McLean. They're in the group. They're still there, but they haven't played with their clubs of late because of injury. Daryl Lenehan and Connor Coventry have been promoted from the under-21 squad. Midfielder Alan Brown admits that his manager has had no luck when it comes to having a full deck to play from, but he remains hopeful that a strong Irish team can take to the field in Serbia.
Yeah, it is. It's a tough one, and it's been that way since Stephen's come in. To be fair, he's been really unfortunate with players, whether that's injury, suspension, or predominantly we've been filled with COVID in the camp, and whether that's people actually getting it or close contact, it's really affected the squad, and he's had short numbers to select from on a few occasions. So, hopefully for this campaign we can keep as many available as possible. We're still waiting on news from one or two, but fingers crossed that we'll have a good selection of players to choose from.
Now our regular analyst Paul Corry joins me on the line. Paul, are you getting worried about Wednesday? That's a long list, isn't it?
It is, Darren, and I do feel for Stephen, like yourself and Alan Brown said there. It seems like we're always patching up the squad and filling holes and trying to get faces in to fill injuries or COVID rules out. But it is a bit worrying. I was looking at just the team that started the Slovakia game, Darren, which was probably our best performance to date under Stephen Kenny. And we're missing five players who started that night from the squad alone. And that would just give you an indication of how many bodies were down. I think the goalkeeping situation is quite worrying in the sense that you're throwing Mark Travers into a huge game. He's only got 12 senior games under his belt. And I think the middle of the pitch is looking a bit bare. And then you still have that old question of where the goal is going to come from. So, listen, it's difficult, Darren. It's going to be a patched-up squad. I still think the 11 we have will be competitive. But it is going to be a massive test heading into Belgrade.
It's a massive week this week for Stephen Kenny, really, isn't it? It's Serbia on Wednesday away and then Luxembourg at home on Saturday. And it's important, isn't it, to hit the ground running in this World Cup campaign?
It is. And Stephen has been given time and there has been patience from, I guess, different stakeholders in Irish football because people want to see him do well and they want to see him be successful. I do think now, particularly with the Luxembourg game is an absolute must win. It's a tight enough squad. The first team goes through automatically, which is, I think we can say with confidence, is going to be Portugal. And then it's going to be a fight for that second spot for the playoff. The game against Serbia aren't what they used to be. They were beaten by Scotland recently in the European Championships qualifiers. So there is hope that we can go there and we can be competitive and we can grind it out. And if somebody offered you a point now, you'd absolutely snatch their hand off. Darren, yeah. And then heading into Luxembourg, that's a must win. Just for the group, for the camp, for Stephen's confidence, and like we've seen in previous group campaigns, a good start is so important if you want to be in with an opportunity come the end of the campaign.
Let's hope we get that. Paul Corry, thanks for joining us on the programme. More on that a little bit later on. Leicester City beat Manchester United 3-1 to advance to the semi-finals of the FA Cup. They'll meet Southampton in the last four. Brilliant performance there yesterday evening from Leicester City. Chelsea got the better of Sheffield United 2-0 and they will meet Manchester City in the semis. In the Premier League, Tottenham beat Aston Villa 2-0 and Arsenal came from 3-0 to draw at West Ham 3-3. What a game that was. Celtic and Rangers played out a 1-1 draw in the Scottish Premiership. Irish amateur Olivia Mahaffey finished inside the top 10 at the Arizona Classic on the Symetra Tour. This is the second tier of the LPGA Tour in the USA. She was tied 6th on 11 under, 6 behind the eventual winner. Shane Lowry finished with a very disappointing 74 on the final day of the Honda Classic to end that event on 1 over par. Matt Jones won it on 11 under. The 2021 flat season got underway at the Curry yesterday and Lafayette took the honours in the Irish Lincoln, the horse ridden by Chris Hayes and trained by Noel Mead, who's had a very good week.
Yeah, it was a good week. We had a nice winner at Cheltenham and that's a help to start off the flat like that, and we had it in our head for a while, even though Mile might have been a bit short. Putting the cheek pieces on him just probably spiked him up a little bit and he was able to ride him. Beautiful ride by Chris. He was able to produce him at the right time.
Yeah, that's Noel Mead. And I'm really looking forward to hearing from Rachel Blackmore. She's going to be on with Mary Wilson later in the programme. So looking forward to listening to that. But finally, from me, some sailing news and a great start to one of the Irish crews competing in the 49er class at the Lanzarote Regatta. To be honest, it's been a really tough time for the Irish sailors because they haven't been able to compete. I think it's maybe 12, 13 months at the stage, but they're back in the water. And this is one of five events which will determine Olympic qualification. Robert Dixon and Sean Whatilove, top of the leaderboard after day one. Ryan Seaton and Shafra Guilfoyle, they're about halfway down the field. Great start, though, for Robert and Sean, although there's a long way to go yet. I'm back with more sport in an hour, but there are sports updates throughout the day on the RTE Sport website and the RTE News app.
We're going to Africa next and the truly terrifying conflict in the Tigray region of Ethiopia. Reports from journalists, internal US government reports, Amnesty International, all tell stories of atrocities against civilians, massacres, rape used as a weapon of war, looted villages, ethnic cleansing. Ethiopian forces, backed by Eritrean troops and local militias, are on one side of this conflict. The indigenous forces of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front are on the other. The region has a population of around 6 million people. Jamal Osman is one of the first outside journalists to report from Tigray. He spent 5 weeks there reporting for Channel 4 News. The second of his reports is due to be broadcast tonight, and he joins us now. Jamal, you're very welcome to the programme. I saw your report from last week. It was truly horrifying. You were focusing on rape being used as a weapon of war against hundreds and hundreds of women. Tonight's report, what will it focus on?
Thank you very much. Tonight's report, we are focusing on massacres. There are one or two massacres reported by the international human rights groups, but when you talk to local people, they said it's widespread, it's happening everywhere. And what we are trying to do is focus on one particular one that happened in Abigrad, about 200 kilometers from the capital city, Mekelle, and just give the victims identity and show their faces and tell the world that this is not just numbers, these are people like us.
And can you tell us a little bit about some of them, the people who were massacred in this?
Yeah, they were a mixture. Some of them were fathers with 7-6 kids, others were young men, like in particular three teenage brothers who were working in this glass factory trying to feed their elderly mother. So yes, there is another one who had three kids. He was a driver working there, trying to feed his kids. So as I said, there were people like us, you know, trying to survive, trying to feed their families, working in most of them in this glass factory, who were rounded up and executed. So we will reveal more, we will tell more tonight, but as I said, it's people like us.
Yeah, exactly. And who is responsible for this, Jamal?
The allegation is that the Eritrean soldiers or men who were wearing Eritrean uniform, and Eritrea is a neighboring country that shares border with Ethiopia, in particular the Tigray region. And they have been fighting over many years. Before the 90s, they were allies to, you know, and they defeated the then Derg regime in 1991. But then they've fallen out and they have been fighting over many years, land dispute and territory. So they don't like each other. And Eritreans felt that the TPLF, when they were running Ethiopia for many years, 27 years, they isolated them and have committed a lot of human rights abuses. So when the locals, you know, when you talk to locals, they will tell you this is revenge, not a war. That's what we are experiencing. So the Eritreans on one side, from the west, it's a group called Amhara, an ethnic Ethiopian group who share border with the Tigray people, who are also allegedly committing serious crimes. And then you have the government, military, the federal police, the intelligence. So it's three different main groups who are fighting against the TPLF.
And I read one report, Jamal, that the TPLF had moved to the mountains and had left the Tigrayan people exposed. Is that true? Where are they?
Yeah, they are hiding in the mountains. And I think it's very important to remind the listeners, the TPLF were the most powerful group in Ethiopia for 27 years. They ruled Ethiopia not only Ethiopia, actually, in the Horn of Africa. So they were very, very powerful group, small but very powerful group. And the local people, the Tigray people, have not expected the TPLF to be defeated that quickly. So they are shocked. They are saying, two years ago, we were the most powerful group in this region, running, you know, not only Ethiopia, but the Horn of Africa. What happened? So they have lots of questions. Yeah, as you said, the TPLF were very powerful. Also, it's important to remember when they were running Ethiopia, they too committed crimes against other communities. There are so many human rights reports that allege TPLF-led regime committed crimes in many different parts of Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm. And how do the Ethiopian authorities see the Tigrayan people? Is it similar in any way to how the Myanmar authorities viewed the Rohingya people?
No, it's not similar. I said there are three main groups that are fighting against the Tigray People's Liberation Front or the Tigray people. And I don't think they have the same objectives. The Ethiopian government, led by the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, wants to defeat the TPLF because they are his main rivals. They are a threat to his leadership. And that is his objective. Then you have the Eritreans who have grievances against the Tigray people or the TPLF, who the local people will tell you are just going crazy and on a revenge and rape and massacres. They are the ones who are committing most of these atrocities. On the other side, you have a rival ethnic group called Amharas, who are also trying to reclaim what they call to be their lands and again committing serious crimes. So I don't think you can say it's one particular group and this is what they are trying to achieve. There are three different groups. All have different objectives, and as far as the main government, the central government is concerned, they just wanted to eliminate the TPLF's threat to Abiy's leadership.
What will end this conflict, Jamal? Is there any end in sight?
It can't be ended with huge international pressure. We are seeing statements and, you know, rhetoric, you know, statements, but the international community needs to, you know, take this issue very seriously, because it's not, the victims are not the government or the TPLF. The victims are women and children, innocent people. These are the real victims of this war, who had nothing to do with politics, nothing to do with TPLF or the Ethiopian government. So I think huge pressure, independent investigation would obviously help, but I think huge pressure that might stop the war that is happening now, that's destroying people's lives in Tigray.
Jamal, your report will be broadcast on Channel 4 News from 7 tonight. Thank you very much indeed, Jamal Osman there, one of the first journalists to report from Tigray.
The Business News with Brian Finn.
Mary, thank you. We need to talk about inflation, so said Taoiseach Leo Varadkar in an interview with the Irish Times over the weekend. And it is a subject that's been rearing its head in the US in particular in recent months. Austin Hughes is chief economist with KBC Bank Ireland. And this has all emerged, Austin, from Joe Biden's stimulus plan and the effect it's had on the bond markets. Is it significant and should we be worried about it here?
Good morning, Brian. I do think inflation is going to rise somewhat, and we may also see in coming years a move to slightly higher interest rates. But in the main, I think that'll be a good thing, because it'll say that we've moved away from the pandemic, which has depressed inflation in recent years. Inflation tends to be a measure of the temperature of the economy, and it's been very cold because of the pandemic. So we would expect to see some bounce. But the reality is, inflation is not the same animal it was 20 years ago. Over the last 10 years, Irish inflation has averaged about 0.5%, and across the euro area as a whole, it's around 1%, way below the ECB's target. So it would be a sign of some economic healing and improvement if inflation picked up a little bit. Now, of course, there are risks that maybe it could go too far, but globally, companies don't have the sort of pricing pressure they would have in the past. And we know similarly that workers don't have the same pressure to ask for significantly higher wages. So in that regard, I think a move to somewhat higher inflation would be a good thing. In the case of Ireland, I think it's also worth pointing out that our very low inflation rate in recent years has been partly caused by the drop in sterling. So if that were to stop, that would also be something that would help our economy. Sorry.
Bearing all that in mind, Austin, the aim of central banks, of course, is to keep inflation at around 2%. Now, they've indicated that they'll tolerate it running a little bit higher for a while. Is that in prospect? Are we looking at that 2% and at what point?
I think a 2% inflation handle across the euro area is not in prospect for the foreseeable future. Now, it should be pointed out that we will see probably over the next couple of months a brief jump in inflation, possibly up towards around 2% because of the rise in oil prices this year, having been very low a year ago. And we did see in 2011 the European Central Bank frightened by higher inflation, raising interest rates, but that won't happen this time. It should also be pointed out that unlike the previous crisis, Irish households and non-financial companies both have higher levels of deposits than borrowings, which is a marked difference. So for some individuals, yes, there may be some pressure if inflation and interest rates move higher. More generally, it's a sign of economic healing, and the most significant risks are around government debt, but there the government can still borrow around zero. So there's space for inflation to move a bit higher, and it probably will be a mark of an improvement in economies rather than something to be terrified about.
And that concern around borrowing, the effect it could have on borrowing costs at a time when all countries are borrowing heavily, the ECB has been buying bonds to stave that off. Could that get beyond their control?
It's possible. We can never say never, given what's happened over the last 15 years or so. But the reality is central banks are very determined. They know the risks of inflation going too low are probably greater than the risk of inflation going a little bit higher. So in that respect, they'll be looking probably towards risks to the downside rather than the upside. And in that regard, we already saw about a week ago, the ECB step up its purchase of government bonds. So it is a risk. Markets are right to be concerned, but I think a little bit higher inflation will be a sign that things are getting better rather than worse.
Austin Hughes of KBC Bank, thank you very much indeed. More business news at 8:30. Audrey.
Well, the weekend brought lots of dry weather, and it will be dry in most areas once again today, but a change in weather pattern will occur from Tuesday, with high pressure declining and low pressure in the Atlantic becoming the dominant feature, bringing more unsettled conditions. For today, well, it'll be mostly cloudy, but with many areas holding dry apart from the odd patch of mist or drizzle. A few sunny spells will occur, these most likely in eastern and southern counties. Maximum temperatures today will range from 10 to 13 degrees. It will stay mostly cloudy across the country tonight, with scattered patches of mist and drizzle, with lows of 5 to 8 degrees. On Tuesday then, there will be a good deal of cloud covering Ireland once again, with a few spots of rain or drizzle. And during the afternoon, a spell of rain is going to push in from the Atlantic to affect western counties, before spreading eastwards across the country. It will then be breezy early on Tuesday night, with that rain clearing into the Irish Sea, and then it will turn quite cold and clear. After a mostly dry start for Wednesday, showery rain will move in from the Atlantic to affect parts of the west and northwest, but further east it will hold mostly dry. Then on Thursday, there'll be showery outbreaks of rain across the country, and it will turn quite blustery too. There'll be some heavy downpours expected, with a risk of hail later in the day, and it will mark the change to colder weather. It'll be cold and showery for Friday and the weekend, and Friday looks set to be a cold and a windy day with sunny spells and widespread showers, some wintry with a risk of hail too. And their early indications suggest the weekend will remain unsettled and showery. So all change for this week. That's the latest forecast. Thanks for listening and have a good week.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, March the 22nd, and this is Morning Ireland with Mary Wilson and Audrey Carvel. The news is read now by Brian Jennings.
Residents of long-term residential care facilities, including nursing homes, can receive two visits per week from today. Guidelines issued by the Department of Health say visits will be allowed on general compassionate grounds, where a facility has a high level of COVID-19 vaccinations. Our social affairs correspondent, Alva Keneally.
Level 5 restrictions introduced at the start of this year have been challenging for much of the population. But for residents and families of those in settings like nursing homes, it's been particularly difficult. Over the past 3 months, some visits were allowed on compassionate grounds, but there are residents who haven't seen loved ones since December. From today, if there's a high level of vaccination in a nursing home, residents can receive 2 visits per week. The guidelines say there's no requirement to limit those visits to less than an hour. Visitors must also wear masks or PPE and book appointments in advance. While some nursing homes are cautious about reopening to visitors, Neffat has said there's an obligation on them to implement the guidelines.
The results of US trials of the AstraZeneca COVID vaccine have been released this morning. Reports say they show it was 79% effective against stopping symptomatic disease and 100% effective at preventing people from falling seriously ill. More than 32,000 volunteers across all age groups took part in the Phase 3 trials, which were also held in Chile and Peru. Around 20% of participants were over 65. The results are expected to pave the way for formal approval for use of the AstraZeneca jab in the United States. The University of Oxford, which developed the vaccine with AstraZeneca, said the latest study shows that it is safe and highly effective. The contract for the mandatory hotel quarantine system is set to be awarded to the TIFCO Hotel Group, RT News understands. The group has 24 hotel properties with over 2,550 rooms in total. The hotels include the Crown Plaza and the Holiday Inn Express next to Dublin Airport, and Travel Lodge hotels at both Dublin and Cork airports. The single contract will see the hotel group provide accommodation and food for those who have to quarantine. It also covers arrangements for transport to the hotels, plus security and testing there. 400 new jobs are to be created in Dublin by US cloud-based finance and human resources software developer Workday. Recruitment for the roles, which span a range of areas, is to begin right away. Our business editor, Will Goodbody.
Workday first came to Ireland in 2008 when it bought Irish technology firm Cape Clear. Today it employs 1,300 people, including 800 engineers, at its European headquarters in Smithfield in Dublin, which it opened in 2015. Now it plans to grow that headcount by a further 30%, adding 400 new jobs to support regional growth and further innovation. The new positions will mostly be in product and technology development, as well as sales, customer operations and other functions. Workday has over 12,000 employees around the world, and its products are used by over 40 million people. The investment is supported by the government through IDA Ireland and has been welcomed by the Taoiseach Tánaiste and Minister for Finance.
Authorities in Miami Beach, Florida, have approved an extension to a state of emergency after thousands of people arrived to celebrate the annual US spring break holiday. City officials fear the gatherings, with few wearing masks and no social distancing, were turning into COVID super spreader events. Reports say at least 50 arrests were made over the weekend for public order offences. Initially, an 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew was due to last until Tuesday, but has now been extended for up to 3 weeks. As part of its insurance reform initiative, the government will today seek views from the public on how to reform the Personal Injuries Assessment Board. The board provides a low-cost and quick route to resolve personal injury claims without having to go to court. Kate Carlan reports.
The Personal Injuries Assessment Board was set up in 2004 to reduce the legal costs of personal injury cases and resolve these issues through mediation rather than litigation. However, the number of cases being finalised before the board has fallen in recent years. The government wants to reform the PIAB so more cases can come before it. This, it says, should save claims costs and ultimately lead to a reduction in insurance premiums. The public consultation begins today, and the deadline for submissions or comments is the 17th of April.
And now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with SuperValu. Get thousands of really low prices in the SuperValu range, available in-store and online. Believe in low prices.
Mostly cloudy today with many areas dry apart from a few patches of mist or drizzle. Occasional sunny spells will occur, these most likely in eastern and southern counties. Highest temperatures 10 to 13 degrees.
The rollout of the hotel quarantine regime and anxiety surrounding rising case numbers are the stories which dominate your front pages this morning. Government bracing for another surge. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Times. The lead headline in the Irish Examiner, meanwhile, notes that the 769 COVID cases reported yesterday marked the highest number of new cases in more than 3 weeks. Both papers also report that the mandatory hotel quarantine regime for passengers arriving from high-risk countries is expected to finally open this week, with the booking system due to go live either today or tomorrow. The Examiner details how, as you'll have heard in the bulletin, the TIFCO Hotel Group, which operates 24 hotels around the country, is likely to be awarded the contract. For its lead story, the Irish Independent reports that members of NPHET called for all passengers flying into the country, and not just from the current list of 33 countries, to be quarantined. The Irish Daily Mirror leads with the line that yesterday's figures mean that Easter celebrations are off again this year. The investigation into the death of two women and a man in Newtown Abbey, County Antrim, on Friday night generates the lead story in both the Irish News and Belfast Telegraph this morning. The Irish Daily Star leads with the 3-year prison sentence which 24-year-old Bernard McGovern received last Friday for an attack on businessmen Kevin Lunny and Dara O'Reilly at a service station in Cavan in February 2019. For its lead story, the Irish Sun interviews a software engineer who says that he has removed more than a million online explicit images, many of which are of Irish women, since last November. The Examiner's political correspondent Aoife Moore writes that according to senior party sources, Fine Gael is in turmoil over the ongoing criminal probe into Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, and that's on the front of this morning's Examiner. Paul Williams reports on the front of The Independent, meanwhile, that Gardaí have already seized almost as many drugs in the first 10 weeks of this year as they did in all of 2020. The plan to build a €25 million whitewater rafting facility in Dublin's Docklands has suffered a setback after the government refused a request to fund it. That's on the front of the Times, as is a story by Carl O'Brien, which quotes the head of the OECD's education division criticising Ireland's educational system, which he says is based on a 20th century model of learning which needs to modernise to avoid producing second-class robots in a world of rapid technological change. The Times also runs with this striking picture on its front page this morning, taken by Nick Bradshaw, showing a siskin and a goldfinch in Delgany, County Wicklow, engaged in a beak-to-beak battle at a bird feeder. As for this morning, The Independent reports on the death of German MP Karen Strenz, a member of Angela Merkel's CDU party, who died in Limerick University Hospital yesterday after a flight she was travelling on from Germany to Cuba had to be diverted to Shannon Airport when she became ill. The Examiner devotes a full page today to the first in a series of features to mark Healthy Ageing Week. Helen Kelleher talks to staff members at Cork University Hospital, tasked with making it an age-friendly hospital. And there's a piece in today's Irish Daily Mail about Hush Restaurant in Rathmines in Dublin, which sold out of sandwiches made with Wagyu beef, a rare Japanese delicacy, which we're told were selling for €90 each.
Professor Martin Cormacan, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning and welcome. You're the HSE's lead for infection control. The headline in the Irish Times this morning saying the government is bracing for another surge. Now, relative to many other countries in the EU, our case numbers are low. But are you worried that that's where we're headed?
We certainly need to be very careful. The numbers that we're looking at over the last couple of weeks are disappointing for all of us. We would all have hoped to be lower by now. It looks like we're pretty much stuck, possibly going back upwards a bit, and there is a real danger of another surge. So we're certainly all hoped, I think, to be in a better place by now than we are, but we have to deal with the reality of where we are, which is that we really need to be very careful.
Well, how real is that danger of another surge? Are you talking about the impact of days like Mother's Day and St. Patrick's Day, which we have to see yet?
Yeah, unfortunately, the two things that are working here is the nature of the virus, which tends to spread, and human nature, which is that we're social beings and that we like to come together. And that's very human and very understandable. But the more we come together, particularly the more we come together indoors, and the larger the numbers of people we meet, the faster the virus spreads. That's really hard, because what's got us through so far is that people have put up with a great deal of isolation and loneliness, and have they borne it as necessary to control the virus? And unfortunately, it's still necessary, because the new strain does seem to spread faster than the one we were used to, and that makes everything harder and makes it harder for everyone.
And when you say more people are coming together indoors, what are you seeing about where the infections are taking place?
Well, I'm speaking in general terms there, that just saying that if people come together indoors, then we're going to see more spread. If people come together at all, there's a risk of spread. The risk is greater indoors. But if people come together, if they come close to each other, if they have contact with each other, that gives the virus an opportunity to spread. What we can see is that, and I think everybody can see this, is that the vast majority of people are trying really hard and are doing their best to keep to the restrictions as much of the time as they possibly can. There are some people who are less careful, and I suppose we continue to appeal to them and to explain to them that the risk that they're taking is not just a risk for them. The risk that they're taking is a risk for everyone that they know and care about, that they might see in the 2 weeks after they take those risks. So I think sometimes people think maybe that they want to take a risk for themselves, but I'd say that the piece that maybe they don't always realise is that every vulnerable person that they meet after that, they're taking that risk to them as well.
But what is happening out there? We've been in level 5 since after Christmas, and yet there is a concern that the numbers are going in the wrong direction. What is coming back through contact tracing and test and trace that is showing you where the infections are taking place?
Well, the infections are taking place in quite a number of different places, and that's to be expected, I suppose, for where people come together. We have to look at then at what are the situations that are most important to us. We know that there's a risk wherever people come together, and some things are so important that we have to continue to do them. We're at the moment, what we're seeing is that the situation in hospitals has improved, the situation in schools is stable, and we are seeing spread in certain workplaces, and we're seeing spread in certain other settings where people come together, and particularly in situations where people forget to keep to the restrictions.
What other settings? Are you talking about houses? Because I think the HSE's lead on test and trace was on This Week a couple of weeks ago, and she mentioned birthday parties, that people were actually having birthday parties inside their homes, and then other things like wakes.
Yeah, these are the kind of situations, and unfortunately the virus, it makes no difference to the virus whether it's a wake or a birthday party. If people come together, the virus will spread in that opportunity. And even though from a human point of view we all understand why people feel these events are very important to them, they are a huge risk to all of us, and so we have to continue to ask people to do the best they can to hold with the restrictions to get us through the period. We all expect that the vaccine is going to make things a lot better for us as we get through this year. So there is hope, and the vaccine has already made a huge difference. I heard on the program earlier that, you know, the fact that we're now beginning to see a bit more visiting in nursing homes. So we are seeing that the vaccine is protecting the people who've had and completed their vaccination course. But that's a very small number, and the amount of vaccine that we've done so far is not enough to slow the spread of the virus in the general community. So what we're left with for now, for the immediate time, is that same difficult restrictions that we've had that have got us so far. And you know, January, as many people know, was an extraordinarily difficult month in the healthcare system. We got through it thanks to the commitment of people who are working on the front line. But
an awful lot of people died in January.
But I think also thanks to they did. But I think the other thing that's really important is that what got us through January was the commitment of the people who made the sacrifice over Christmas and New Year to keep themselves to themselves, to keep their distance. What got us through January was not only the commitment, as I say, in the work of the front line, but also the home front of the people who kept that commitment to what was a really hard thing to do through Christmas in January, and people stuck with it, and that got us through.
The government says that the mandatory quarantine will come into effect this week. From your perspective, infection control, should all passengers arriving from every country be asked to go into a hotel for a period of time? Does it make sense to you to have some people coming into the country and not being asked to do that?
With all of these situations, I think that there's a difficult issue about balancing risk, and everything that we do has to be proportionate, and those judgments are sometimes difficult. And the current approach is to look at those countries which appear to represent the greatest risk and to concentrate on those and to keep that list under continuous review. And that's a reasonable approach because, of course, the risk is, the big risk with travellers is travellers coming into the country. The big risk that we're looking at there is that somebody might bring in a variant that will be harder for us to control. So I think the approach that's been taken is reasonable. It's a proportionate approach. And it is an ongoing issue of looking at that decision all the time and deciding is the list of countries as complete as it needs to be?
Yeah, because at the moment there's only one EU country on that list and it's Austria. Would you expect, given that the case numbers across the EU are rising, would you expect that list to expand and to include other EU countries?
Well, the main concern for me about people coming into the country is whether they're coming from a country where there's a high chance that there's going to be a variant of the virus that will prove harder for us to control. So more than if they're coming from a country that's looking at what is mainly the same type of virus as we already have, then the risk in that situation is lower. The main concern is about people coming from places that might, where there's a risk that they might bring to us a virus that the vaccine doesn't work so well against. That's the biggest single risk. And the approach that's been taken is to try to identify those countries that are the greatest risk for that and to try to manage the risk around those countries where that risk is greatest. And that's a reasonable approach. It is all of these decisions that are being made are trying to balance the risks between the fact that people have to live and we have to control the virus and the decisions about travel from other countries and the decisions about how we live our lives, opening schools. All of those decisions are all about balancing risks, trying to make sure that we are able to live and do the things that are most important to us, but with the lowest possible level of risk.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Martin Cormacan, HSE Lead for Infection Control. It's 8:22.
And the CEO of the Irish Medical Organisation, Susan Klein, told RTÉ's Radio's This Week programme yesterday that it was in advanced discussions with the HSE about how GPs can help with vaccinating some of those in the COVID high-risk category. Some GPs took to Twitter. They said they were unaware of these discussions and they expressed some anger that their workload was once again being added to. Here's Monaghan GP, Dr. Ilona Duffy.
Well, I'm hugely concerned because already we're seeing that our normal day-to-day GP services and thus our access to patients with acute problems is being limited by the rollout of the over 70s vaccinations in our practices. We felt that, and the understanding was that that would be the only role we'd play in our normal daytime surgeries, and that after that we would also be able to offer our services in out-of-hours times and at weekends to the community COVID vaccine clinics. Absolutely, I know that most GP practices are computerised, but we're not necessarily all as well computerised, and let's say with regards to coding and being able to pull up the data on specific patients. And it will take a huge body of work because this isn't necessarily work that our admin staff can do, because obviously it relates to patients and clinical data. So it will have to be ourselves, our GP nurses in the main, who are going to be trawling through our records to kind of get the details. And I think we have worked hard and well during this pandemic to provide care to patients, plus deal with the COVID referrals and COVID infections. We've also accepted the vaccination of the over 70s with all the difficulties that have been well highlighted with that. But I think now we have to be able to concentrate on our practices. And therefore, I'd be saying to the HSE, look, you have this information. Absolutely, we'll help. But please do not expect that every GP practice will be able to start vaccinating the at-risk groups in their practices.
Dr. Ilona Duffy there. Now, Dr. Dennis McCauley is a GP and he's chair of the IMO's GP committee. Good morning, Dennis McCauley.
Good morning, Mary.
We were listening to Ilona Duffy there. Are you and the HSE trying to bounce GPs into taking on this additional work that they hadn't anticipated?
First of all, we're not trying to bounce anybody in, and the lack of anticipation. I think an awful lot of general practitioners are contacting us, me directly and the Irish Medical Law Organisation, wanting to get involved in these vaccinations. I think we've got to look at it in the context. If we look at the very high risk group, the group that we've been actually asked to get involved with, that's 150,000 people. For an average general practitioner, that's 30 to 40 patients that they have to identify. A single-handed GP and his practice nurse can do 24 vaccinations in an hour. So we're not talking about a huge amount of work that to do these very high-risk group. The next group, really, that the people with medical conditions, and they're defined as people with high risk. These are the people we give the flu vaccine to, and so we have knowledge of them. The other issue is that the amount of people that we're going to vaccinate, that we're in discussions to vaccinate, this other group, represents about 500,000 people. Normally when we vaccinate a million of these people, and last time in October when we did it in 6 weeks, so we're doing half that number. So is it an extra burden? Yes, it is. Will it affect our day-to-day activities? I don't think it will. And actually, finally, do the vast majority of general practitioners want to get involved in this? They do. They definitely do. And they're quite willing to do it. Now, at the same time, I'm not here as being as a cheerleader for the HSE. I think if we can get a guarantee of vaccine, and we know how much we're going to get, and if we have good communication, I think the vast majority of GPs will just quietly get on with this. We are actually that's what we want to do, but it'll depend on, once again, Mary, the typical question: the supply of vaccine.
Okay,
and,
but is
if we can get warning that we're actually going to get it.
Okay, but is it still anticipated then in this plan that some patients in the high-risk category, the cancer patients, for example, that they'll still go to hospitals, others like people suffering from diabetes or other chronic conditions, that they will work through the GP practice?
I think almost definitely the first group that we're talking about is this group 4A, which represents the people who are very high risk group. These are people who it's deemed to be, it is essential that we vaccinate them as quickly as possible. Now, at the very beginning, it was thought that most of these people attended the hospital, but that isn't the case. There is a group of them, people, as you mentioned, with cancer, people who are on dialysis, people who have significant immune problems. They definitely attend the hospital. But The other part of that cohort, people with diabetes, which isn't well controlled, the severely overweight people, they almost exclusively come to their GP.
We can
identify these people. I think the wonderful thing about general practice, most of us have very good IIT, and we can identify these people. But as I say, that's possibly maybe 40 to 50 patients per GMS list.
I just wonder, though, who will decide and who will be communicating with the patient? Will it be the GP who will have to decide and tell a patient, no, you must go back to your hospital, your treating hospital, whereas Y can come straight to the practice?
Well, I think it just depends on if we have vaccine, Mary. I think that if we have enough vaccine, if somebody who is on dialysis decides to come to our, it all starts with if we have the vaccine. I would anticipate that the hospital-based practice, I would anticipate that they will get the vaccine before us. So I would imagine that the people who normally attend the hospital will probably be vaccinated before the people who attend general practice. But if they happen to be given the supplies at the same time, I don't see GPs refusing the patient from the very high risk that normally attend the hospital. But I really don't see that happening. I think at the present minute, the very high risk group who attend the hospital are being vaccinated.
Okay, what can you tell us about this week and what is happening in GP surgeries around the country this week? I think Susan Klein yesterday was talking about something under 90,000 doses of vaccine scheduled to go to 500 general practices.
Yes, we're in the second week of it is complicated, but we have finished vaccinating the over 85s. We have I think most of the over 80s actually vaccinated. So we're moving to the 75 to 80 group. Now that was hampered last week, unfortunately, by a supply issue. That will continue for the next 2 weeks, and then hopefully we will be able to replenish supplies and move to the finish the over 75s and then the 70 year olds. So hopefully we anticipate that we will still hopefully finish the vaccination of the over 70s on schedule. We've given 250,000 vaccines so far.
And what is that deadline then? What is that date to finish them?
In the middle of May. We would have that each of this cohort will have their second, the over 70s will have their second vaccination by the middle of May.
Dr. Dennis McCauley, thank you very much for your time.
The Turkish lira has fallen by as much as 14% after President Recep Tayyip Erdogan sacked the country's central bank governor over the weekend. Naci Ağbal is the third governor to depart in under 2 years. Appointed in November, he had been raising interest rates to try to bring inflation in Turkey under control. Food delivery company Deliveroo has set a price range of between £3.90 and £4.60 per share for its initial public offering. That would value the company at between £7.6 and £8.8 billion. It's set to be Britain's biggest share listing in more than 7 years. Commercial and office property group Ugrove REIT managed to grow its portfolio, reduce vacancy rates and improve profitability in 2020 despite the impact of the pandemic. The group grew its rent roll by over a fifth to just below €11 million, according to its annual results. On the currency markets, the euro is trading at just below $1.19 and 85.8 pence sterling.
And at 8:34, it's back to Darren Frahill for the sports news. Morning, Darren.
Good morning again, Audrey. Well, it's a crucial week for the Irish soccer team with the start of the World Cup campaign. We're away to Serbia on Wednesday, and then it's a home game against Luxembourg on Saturday. But more withdrawals for manager Stephen Kenny to contend with. Caoimhín Kelleher, Kevin Long, Conor Hourihan and Callum O'Dowda have all been ruled out of the squad because of injury. It's another blow for the Irish manager, already missing Darren Randolph, John Egan, James McCarthy, Adam Eda and Jack Byrne, and two others, Aaron Connolly and James McLean. They're still in the group, but they have not played with their clubs of late because of injury. Dara Lenehan and Conor Coventry have been promoted from the under-21 squad. It's a long list, but this group has no choice. They must push ahead now and focus on that big game on Wednesday. And recent form has not been good, but this is a clean slate, and midfielder Alan Brown is not too bothered with those who have already written them off before a ball is kicked.
Yeah, I can't wait. You know, recent results and campaigns have been really disappointing from our perspective, and certainly under this manager we want to get things rolling and, you know, get results as soon as possible. And what a way to do it, you know, to go into these next few games now, try get some wins, or if not, don't be beat, and get some points on the board. On paper, people probably rule us out, if we're being realistic, you know, given our recent results, haven't been doing well enough. So I'm sure the critics will have already ruled us out, but us as a team and as a nation, you know, we're always ones to thrive off this and be the underdog and come out on top, and that's what we'd be looking to do. You know, we've got to be as optimistic as possible, and we'll be going into every game looking to win it. It's been a long time since this country has taken part, and, you know, as a footballer growing up, that's the dream, that's the big stage that you want to get to. And, you know, we're all here now, we've got a chance to put things right and finally qualify for one, and, you know, give people at home a bit of hope and you know, something to cheer about in these tough times.
Yeah, we could certainly do with it. Live on Radio 1 and RTE2 on Wednesday, 7:45 start, Ireland against Serbia. Now, Leicester City beat Manchester United 3-1 to advance to the semi-finals of the FA Cup. They'll meet Southampton in the last four. Chelsea got the better of Sheffield United 2-0, and Manchester City await them in the semis. In the Premier League, Tottenham beat Aston Villa 2-0, and Arsenal came from 3 down to draw 3-3 with West Ham. Celtic and Rangers played out a 1-1 draw in the Scottish Premiership. Now, let's reflect on an incredible weekend in the Six Nations. In a moment, the thoughts of Bernard Jackman. But first, let's listen back to how the Irish restored pride against England and France pulled off the greatest of escapes with two late tries against Wales. Emotions running high both in Dublin and Paris on Saturday evening.
Here comes Keith Earls, got us it now. Races inside the 22-metre line. Goes for the corner. Earls, far side of the pitch. Looks to touch it down. In for the try.
Baptiste Serin le libère, choix de jeu, pivot, encore Tamac, Sifou, Sifou, sur un large, Barcelone, on essaie de briser le Nord, mais c'est fou, c'est incroyable cet essai de brise du Nord, qui permet aux Français de s'imposer, oh là là.
In the end, what really matters in that sport is just to believe. I've lost my voice, but we won the game, and it's pretty simple, we're still in it, and we still, the next game will define all Six Nations.
5 metres short back of Jack Connor. Is it charges forward with that one as he gathered the ball and touches it down. And England have been absolutely ripped to shreds.
Dreams do come true, and it's been a pleasure for me and my family. And just from the bottom of my heart, thank you very much for all the messages and the kind words. It's a special team, yeah. Things are going to happen for this team, and it's going to be a privilege to watch them. Guys, just grateful.
I love that ooh la la from the French commentator. Bernard Jackman, as we know, one of the tough guys in Irish rugby. But I have a good word, Bernard, from the weekend. You were crying after that interview with CJ Standard. True or false?
No, I wasn't crying, but I do feel I feel for him, to be honest. I think given the career he's had, given the reasons he's having to retire because of obviously family and COVID, not having his family there, and having a crowd there to show him how much we appreciate his legacy in Ireland. You know, he's contributed so much to the red and green, and he went out on an absolute high, and the players. There was that added emotion for him. I think they wanted to give him a fitting send-off because he's been involved in helping others go out on a high. So, tough to see, but look, at least he got to go out with a big win against our old rivals.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that win. How important was it in terms of the Irish cause, Bernard?
Look, I think it's massive. There has been a bit of discontent, and certainly I didn't see it coming, and I pulled my hand up and got it wrong. That's the performance that we've been waiting for as rugby analysts, I think. I think there's good players in this team, and it all came together on Saturday. And I think, look, it's only one game, but I think it can have a big influence on our performances as we go forward, because I think if you look back on it, they haven't really had that, you know, signature win since the end of 2018. It's they've beaten the teams they're expected to beat, but England came here, you know, full of the same players who won a Grand Slam last year, World Cup finalists, won the Autumn Cup, and we dealt with them really comprehensively, and it was excellent. So I think, bar the 4 points we got for that win, I think it'll just settle everyone down. It'll give the players confidence in the methods that Andy Farrell and the coaching staff are giving him, and I think the public will now start to really get behind him in a massive way, rather than we were all a little bit sceptical, I think. So I think it's going to be huge for us.
How good were France on Saturday night, and can they win the championship next Friday with that rearranged game against Scotland?
Yeah, well, just to win the championships, they've got to beat Scotland in Paris with a bonus point and by more than 21 points. So it's certainly not easy. I mean, Scotland have have a nice buffer there in terms of being able to help Wales win the championship. I think they can do it, though. I think they're going to get massive confidence from that to come back against Wales. They had a man sent off, but they didn't let up. They kept putting pressure on. Wales eventually had two men in the bin, and to score a try in injury time was just unbelievable. And I think that they will go after it, and they'll attack Scotland. So I think it's going to be a fascinating game on Friday night. It's going to be difficult, but I think they can do it. And I think, look, I'll be honest, if they do it, they deserve to win the championship. And I think probably they have been the best team, really, over the course of the competition. Wales grew into the competition, but got plenty of breaks, to be fair. And the fairness played a part in an unbelievable game against France Saturday night. But I think France are the best team, and particularly... Okay. As we go forward, I think they're the youngest team, and they've got the most potential and probably play the best brand of rugby.
Roll on Friday night. Thanks as always, Bernard Jackman. That's all your sport for now.
I'm going to stay on a sporting high now. Have a listen to this.
Honeysuckle is galloping clear as she races towards the last. A lovely leap. She cleared it safely and heads up the hill now. Honeysuckle and Rachel Blackmore clear from Sharjah Epitant behind those. It's a beautiful straight 11 victories for Honeysuckle. She is the winner of the Unibet Champion Hurdle.
Rachel Blackmore, good morning.
Good morning, Mary. Thanks for having me on.
It's an absolute pleasure, Rachel. You made racing smile again. You brought a smile to the face of the country. We're all so proud of you. Have you had a chance at all to reflect on the week you had in Cheltenham?
Look, it's been an incredible week. I definitely brought a smile to my own face anyway, under my mask. suppose it's hard to comprehend the last few days, to be honest. But yeah, it's been a bit of a whirlwind.
And then you didn't come home on Friday and put your feet up and perhaps bask in the incredible achievement, you know, champion jockey, breaking records, first woman achieving incredible success. You went back out to Thurles on Saturday and won again, and then to Downpatrick.
Yeah, look, I suppose that's the life that a jockey leads. We're straight back into it when we come home, but when you're coming back from Cheltenham with winners under your belt, it's a lot easier to float around the place, I can tell you.
When you set out for Cheltenham more than a week ago now, what were your ambitions? What was your hope?
Yeah, look, I was heading over to Cheltenham with a very good book of rides. So, you know, there was a lot of expectation there. But Cheltenham is an extremely hard place to win. Everyone knows that. So you're hoping that one of them might do it for you. So obviously when Honeysuckle won the champion hurdle on Tuesday, that was just a massive moment. Relief as well as anything else. But yeah, you're just hoping one of them can do it. And I could never have envisaged what transpired.
It wasn't just one, it wasn't two, it was six. And you, I keep hearing you praise the horses and you praise De Bromhead and Mullins, but you're the one aboard these horses and you've got to steer them over these incredibly challenging courses. Malachy Clerken, I saw saying about you that you won in a variety of styles. Do you plot out each race according to the horse that you're aboard?
Definitely. I think every horse is different. They all have their own personalities and, you know, they all like to be ridden in different styles. Some horses prefer to be allowed gallop on in front. Others prefer or need to get a little bit of cover out the back to get them to relax. So they all have their different styles and different quirks. But for me as a rider, you know, riding for the likes of Henry, De Bromhead, Willie Mullins, you know, it makes your life a lot easier. They're fantastic trainers. Henry's achievement this week to win the Champion Hurdle, Champion Chase and Gold Cup, that's something that's never been done before. You know, it's absolutely incredible what he's done this week.
And I know you say it's no big deal now being a female jockey, but it is a big deal, Rachel. You and others before you, like Katie Walsh and Nina Carberry, you have broken through a glass ceiling, haven't you?
I suppose when I came into racing, Katie and Nina had already broken that for me. They never made a big deal out of it, so I just continued on with their ethos. I feel inside of racing it's not a big deal. Maybe on the outside world it is, but you know, we're very lucky to be involved in a sport where gender isn't an issue or made any deal about, so I'm very grateful for racing in that sense.
Why racing? Your mum has been talking to RT and other stations over the last week or so about your love of horses from a very early age, that you were always out there, you were always ambitious and you were always competitive.
Yeah, look, I grew up on a farm surrounded by ponies, and you know, my parents trucked me and my brother and sister around the country to, you know, pony club events and eventing and hunting and so on. So, yeah, we grew up around it. And, yeah, look, I always loved horses and ponies. They've given me some of the best days of my life.
Mm. You're never flustered, they say. No heroics. You're cool under pressure. When you're out there traveling at those incredible speeds on these amazing animals, are you ever fearful?
No, I think if you're a jockey and you know you're thinking about what could go wrong, it's probably time to not be a jockey as your profession. So yeah, being fearful isn't really something that you can have on your brain when you're doing our job.
And how are you getting on the injury front? Are you a lucky jockey?
Yeah, look, touch wood, I've been very lucky. We have a very good medical team headed by Dr. Jennifer Pugh, who keeps us sound, and she's done a fantastic job in the last while. especially bringing us over to Cheltenham under very strict, you know, COVID protocols and so on. She's done a massive job for racing, and I know all the jockeys are extremely thankful of all her very hard work.
And what's next, Rachel? Aintree in your sights, of course.
Yeah, we've Fairy House, we've Aintree, and then we're on to the Punchestown Festival. So it's all go at the moment for racing. But yeah, I think I'm still trying to draw breath from the last few days.
I can imagine. When are you going to draw breath? Are you going to have a chance to go home to Killinall, to meet family and friends, to have a chance to sit back and just take it all in?
Yeah, we've no racing on Wednesday, so I might get a chance to watch back some of the replays then. But at the moment, we're on a 5-day quarantine after travelling back from the UK. So, yeah, we'll assess everything when that's done and out of the way.
When you watch back those races, Rachel, will you watch them back with a critical eye to see perhaps... People will say you couldn't do better, but you'll probably say you could. Or will you watch them for the sheer pleasure of the occasion and the achievement?
Yeah, there's one or two you'll watch back maybe with a critical eye, but I don't think I'll be dwelling on them for too long, and I think I'll enjoy the other ones.
As you should indeed. Had you a favourite race? Was it Honeysuckle?
Yeah, look, I think Honeysuckle, you know, she's so special. She's unbeaten. She's a champion hurdle winner. I'm so lucky to be associated with her. That was just a massive moment for me to win a race like the champion hurdle. You know, that's a race at the pinnacle of our sport. So, yeah, I think that was my special moment of the week.
What about, you know, for children in Tipperary Pony Club, as you once were now, or in pony clubs around the country, who look at you now as a role model and think, you know, I want to be Rachel Blackmore when I grow up. What advice would you give them? Your mother said, I think there's a big post bag awaiting you at home in Tip.
I suppose when I was in Pony Club, I never thought I could be a Rachel Blackmore. So I think, you know, I think just for all of them, just to dream however they want to, and you know it can be achieved. So you know, if you work hard and you get the opportunities, I suppose anything can happen.
Anything can happen indeed. The great Rachel Blackmore talking to us a little earlier.
How should our villages, towns and cities change after the pandemic? Will they change? Well, this week online, Sligo is hosting a conference examining how to reimagine itself. And one of the speakers will be Jens Tom Iverson, creative director for the city of Gothenburg in Sweden. His nickname is Rain Man because his Rain Gothenburg project aims to make it the best city in the world to live in when it rains. It rains 40% of the time there. We know a bit about that. He's been telling us more.
One thing is that us as humans, we need to go outdoors. And if it's one thing that the pandemic showed us, it's that we need it even more to be able to come out and actually also socialize, but keeping the distance outdoors. So if you live in a country where it's a lot of rain, it's kind of obvious that you have something you have to deal with there. I noticed that it's very rarely actually that countries or cities, as our city in Gothenburg in Sweden, is the same. We don't really take use of the rain in a way that we could, which is, you know, dealing creative with it.
And well, let's talk about what you have done, because in this country, when it rains, most of us try and run indoors as quickly as possible. Unless you're a child, children love the rain. And in Gothenburg, you have really transformed your playgrounds because of the rain. Will you tell us what you've done?
Yes, so far we started that work with the playgrounds to transform them into rain playgrounds, because we also, Gothenburg is quite a rainy city. And that means that we have some dry places, which means small roofs, so you can be underneath when it is raining. But that's not enough. We're really trying to look at it as how can we also lift out the qualities within rain. So these roofs, they gather the water, the rainwater, and leads it to a pipe in the end, and brings it down to a thing where the children can play with it and gather it. So we're creating those places where you want to go when it's raining. And it's not only because you're dry, it's also actually some kind of bonus effect in terms of art or installations that could be activated. In a way, it's really simple, but actually very effective.
And I was interested to hear in another park that you had put in shelters and barbecues, and one particular shelter is used as a classroom during the day and then it's designated as a hub for the homeless at nighttime.
Yes, it's a project out in a harbour, and so during daytime it's an outdoor classroom for children and teachers, of course, and well, anyone. It's also a playground, so you can go there no matter if you have a class or not. And also it's a container that it's built up with some Spanish architects that did a fantastic job. So in the nighttime, there is also a container there, and there is this, of course, it's always some parts is shelter from the weather, so to speak, rain and wind. So it's totally okay for homeless people to go there in the night. Homeless people in the city, when it rains, they are the most vulnerable, and so we need to deal with that in some way or the other. So
that's a very good point. And you mentioned they're working with artists and poets and harnessing their creativity. And you've done that to great effect in Gothenburg by putting, well, you've put poems on manhole covers, and you have a special type of paint, is it, that only runs when it rains?
It only comes out when it rains. It makes the surface kind of, the water just bounces off. So if you have a concrete surface, so to speak, you it's very graphic, it's very clear. You see it very clear. The reason why we do all this is actually to put attention to rain, because that's something we need to. We don't expect to all of a sudden that people will start loving rain, but actually we started this different approach to rain, working with artists that lifts rain in different ways, and also of course it's a environment project, climate project, where we work with how can we deal with rain in a city in a more sustainable way and green and blue way. So it's a lot of different projects, small and big projects, everything around rain in a creative way.
A blank canvas here. Jens Toms Iversen there, who is the creative director for the city of Gothenburg in Sweden. Before we go, we're going to head to Brussels and talk to our Europe editor, Tony Connolly, because Tony, Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson, he's going to ask EU leaders this week to dismiss any plans to block the export of the COVID-19 vaccine to his country. What's being said?
Well, Audrey, the acrimony between the EU and UK doesn't show any signs of letting up over the vaccine issue. And in particular, there's a focus on a vaccine production facility in the Netherlands called Halix. And the UK is due to get a finished product there for the AstraZeneca vaccine. But the EU, as you know, the European Commission has been threatening export curbs of product to other countries if those other countries are not reciprocating in sending vaccines to the EU. And of course, the central critique of the European Commission has been that AstraZeneca has been meeting the demands in the UK, but denying vaccines to European member states who have a contract with AstraZeneca to get vaccines. And we've seen a big shortfall there. Now, there's been a proposal by the European Commission president to invoke even stronger export control legislation. And that's going to be discussed by EU leaders in Brussels this week. Well, they were supposed to come to Brussels, but because of the situation, it's going to be a virtual meeting. And Boris Johnson is going to be contacting individual leaders to try and convince them not to increase any curbs of exports, especially around this plant in the Netherlands. We'll have to see if he has any success. As you know, attempts by the UK to divide and rule over Brexit with individual countries didn't get very far.
Okay.
But certainly some member states have reservations about deepening these export curbs.
Okay, we shall watch that one closely. Tony Connolly in Brussels, thank you very much. It's a minute to nine.